Hi all. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Siobhan Kelly and I am the host of the Glass House podcast, and I'm really happy to be back. We have a great guest today. His name is John Kennedy and he is the head of HR organizational development at Erin Road Erin. So for those of you who live in the UK or America, Erin Road Erin is also known as Irish Rail. So welcome, John.
Thanks very much, Siobhan. Thanks for having me.
I know, I kind of browbeat him onto becoming a guest on the podcast. But before we get into anything else, can you actually tell us what the head of HR organizational development does or is responsible for?
The role kind of came into existence about four years ago. We started off looking to introduce a new payroll system for the company. We had an old legacy payroll system that was originally designed in the 1960s, so the company kind of needed to move on, and we went out to tender for cloud systems and things like that. And it sort of developed from there, from a point of view of looking at HR projects that were outside of the basic line HR duties. So we have two main organizational teams, infrastructure and railway operations. So in order to leave the HR managers looking after the line HR duties and the usual type of stuff, my role was kind of created, and it's been expanded from a team of three to we have a team of 16 now. We're implementing a new patient management system for our chief medical officer. We're implementing the Oracle Cloud HCM solution and any other sort of projects that are people related within Irish Rail sort of fall under my remit. So that's kind of where the role kind of came about.
Yeah, and I was looking when I was stalking your LinkedIn profile, you've actually been with the same company since 2002, I think, if memory serves.
No, well, that's what LinkedIn. I've been in sort of various managerial roles since then, but I'm being with the company. I started off as an apprentice, a fitter by trade.
Wow.
So I started in 1983 with the company, and then apart from the 3.5 years working outside in a few small engineering companies, I came back into the organization in June in 1990, and I've been with the organization since then.
What's really interesting to me about that, because obviously I'm in recruitment, so I always say to people that there's kind of nothing really that can take you off your path. Like, there's no really bad decisions. You'll always find your way back to your career, to the way you want to develop within your career. But like, you started off as an apprentice. Did you ever think at that time that you would end up with a title such as this? Like, was it even like in the realm of possibilities for you?
No, not in the slightest. I can remember my one and only career guidance conversation in secondary school. At that stage, I kind of wanted to work in a bank. I don't know why. Mathematically orientated or things like that. But I don't know. It had an allure for me, I suppose, back when I was 16. So between that and then wondering, listening to Morrissey, trying to find out clothes that I didn't have to wear and things like that. My father just approached me in February of 83, handed me a few application forms and said, fill them in. And I kind of said, I don't really want to be an apprentice. And fathers of that generation had a way of just looking at you. And I said, okay. So I applied for four different organizations. And was lucky enough, got offered COE as it was at the time, became an apprentice. It was very formative for me personally. Mm. The 4 years I had, got let go in 1987 as all of us did at the time. And as I said, worked in a few small engineering firms on lathes, milling machines, things like that, you know, general maintenance. And just received a letter one day back in April of 1990, looking to say come for an interview. So I came back from an interview and then started as a maintenance fitter in the locomotive department in Erin Road Erin. So that's how it kind of came about.
Yeah. And in relation to what you were saying there about, well, you know, fathers in those days, it was like, I think the bank as well was seen as a safe job, you know.
Yeah.
Initially, because I remember I worked in a bank for a period as well, and it just was not it wasn't my vibe, you know. So I think the reality is a little bit different. But when you went in to become the apprentice, and you know, you kind of followed your dad's, let's say, in a inverted commas, advice, that you still kind of like built out your own path. Like, how did you end up going from like the apprentice slash fitter side of things into a more office-based role?
I kind of always wanted, for some strange reason, to do the Leaving Cert. And having seen my two sons sort of go through it over the last 4 years, I sort of said, my God, was I deluded ever wanting to do that exam? But I did, for some personal reason, and got talking to, as you do, like over tea and cigarette breaks, not that I ever smoke, but with the other lads sort of smoking away. And I sort of said, yeah, I'm thinking of doing this. And one fella says, why would you not go on to school? He said, go to college. He says, you're 23, you know, you'd be a mature student, you could be accepted. Never really thought anything more about it. Started to look into the Open University, things like that. At the time then, I became a shop steward in my section, in my department. And started to do a certificate in trade union studies with the Irish Congress of Trade Unions. And there was the guy who was doing the course, Michael Murphy, I think is his name, Michael Murray maybe, I'm not 100% sure. He said to me after a few months, he says, there's no point in you finishing this certificate. He says, you should go out to Ranelagh, which was the National College of Industrial Relations, which is now National College of Ireland here in the IFSC. And so I started talking to a few lads in personnel that I knew at the time in Inchicore, where I worked. And the company had a scheme where they used to pay 50% of your studies. So I applied and got it, and sort of was accepted onto the program. So I did my undergrad in industrial relations and personnel management. And so always through that, then came to my first assignments, 3,000 words on economics. And I liked economics as a kid in school, very interested in subjects, still am. And so I approached again my friend in personnel, and I said, could you give us any tips? How do you write a 3,000 word essay? And he says, I'll tell you who you need to talk to. You need to talk to an individual in human resources in Connolly, as it was then called then. That individual came out, met me. Took an interest. We used to sit across the table at negotiations, and then he got the head of HR job at the time, rang to congratulate him, and he says, would you like to come down and consider a career here? And I sort of said, okay. Went down and met him, had a chat with him, and he said, when would you like to start? So that's how it came about. A bit of fluke, but put myself out, I suppose.
Yeah, and that's what I was going to say to you, because everybody always says that, like, that, you know, it's a bit of a fluke, but I do think it's like, I don't know if it's a Chinese proverb or something, but it's like, you know, opportunity, like the character for it is like hard work. Yeah, it's hard work and a little bit of luck. But
yeah,
would you say then, because it seems from what you've just told us that you kind of had the mindset to say yes to a lot of things, even if you felt a bit like, oh, you know, I don't know if this is more than what I'm capable of.
Yeah, that would be true. And kind of in the lead up to that, we were doing this project. I was still working on the tools, and we were going for ISO accreditation for 9001 for my department, and we're trying to put together the work instructions, the operating procedures, and the administration around the whole documentation. And we ran into resource issues. So we're at a meeting, and the quality team were saying that we're going to, we haven't got the manpower to deal with it. So I said, I know someone who'll do it. And they all looked and said, who? And I said, I will. And my colleagues kind of were just, you know, casually looking right and left at me and things like that. And they came to me, they said, are you serious? And I says, yes, I'll give it a blast. So before, that was my first, I started working in the technical department, writing up procedures and instructions. And then I moved on to the industrial relations team, as was in head office in Connolly.
What I think is like really important, and I try and say this if I'm like career coaching or giving advice, that sometimes, like if we do career mapping, like if you were to look at where you started and then where you are now, I won't say where you're finished because who knows, but like where you are now, that jump is so huge. But like your career never pans out like that. It's always like saying yes to the next right step. That's all it is. If you had advice to somebody who was starting off now, what would you say to them? Like, what is the biggest thing you think that got you from where you started to where you are now?
Well, I suppose if I was to sort of the way I look at things is, if I paraphrase the quotation on the Parnell Monument at the bottom of O'Connell Street, no man has a right to put a stop to the march of a nation. So if you think about it personally, you or I or whatever is the only limiting factor in anything, right? You just sometimes have to jump off the pier into the 8 foot water, 10 foot water, and sort of, trust that you can swim. That's obviously allowed, presume you can swim, sorry. But
Yeah,
just to
don't
take
worry.
that leap, and I found that there's always someone who'll help you. People are good. People are inherently good. And if you look for the help, you take the advice, it will come good. Like when I said about my apprenticeship being formative, it was very paternal. And apprenticeships by their nature, like, I mean, if you go back to through the annals of time and look at how they came about and things like that, and it is a very sort of paternalistic or maternalistic type of role, do you know what I mean? And I learned so much from individuals I worked with who looked after you. So you're a raw 17-year-old kid. You're coming into an industry, heavy engineering and things like that, and suddenly you're alongside 55, 56, 45, 46-year-old men, well, predominantly men as it was at the time, and they've so much life experience, as well as engineering experience. And if they can give you that, and if you can be a sponge, as I said, I think you're your own limiting factor.
Yeah, it's really
That I
interesting.
personally believe that.
No. And I wrote that down because I was like, I need to have a look at that quote. I have a what I call him a little cousin. He's 19, so he did his leaving cert last year, and he was adamant that he didn't want to go to college. And obviously, his older cousins had gone to college, and it was like, this was the new way that things were, and he just felt like that it wasn't for him. So he got himself a job in Brennan, so he's working in there full time, and then he's going to go on and do an apprenticeship next year. He wanted to save his money, get his car, do his driving lesson. So he had a full plan. And one of the things that he had said to me is that like the lads and the men that he works with, they give him all types of life advice, and they've been there for years and years, and like even helping, with his savings plans and what to be doing.
Absolutely.
And he's really like benefited from their experience. What would you say though as well? Because there's, I suppose, for me in recruitment, there's a staffing shortage, or like in the sense of a candidate shortage. And I'm sure you find it yourself, like sometimes it's hard to attract people and also into the apprenticeships. Now I know the government is doing a lot to try and attract people into it. Is there anything that you think that we could be doing differently for the younger like people to show them that college straight out of school, because I think it's mad to ask someone who's 17 or 18 if they know exactly what they want to do with the rest of their life. Do you think there's a different way to encourage them into apprenticeships, or what the benefits of them are, or those are?
I think there is, and the example I would give in the sense of as part of I did fifth year, so I did 1 year towards the leaving cert, and I was doing physics. And to say I didn't get it would be an understatement. There was lads at the top of the class, and just went to a boys' school, so there was lads at the top of the class, and they're all sitting there. They'd never have their books open, and just it all clicked. They just all, and I'm sitting there sort of writing furiously and then looking at the book and sort of saying no. So fast forward, 9 months, 8 months, and suddenly I'm in Bolton Street doing block release, and we used to go for a day and a half a week, and we do engineering theory, we do mechanical drawing, and we do engineering science. So suddenly, because you're working at it, the signs
Makes
just
sense.
sort of started to click. So I started to get the concepts that the teacher in school was trying to get to me. And I think it's the practicalities of an apprenticeship, I think, are huge. I really do. I mean, the Germany has been doing it for years, the whole model of learning. And part of an exchange program, we took some German apprentices just before COVID. And actually, their stay was during the start of COVID. So we had to get them home furiously, really quickly, because the announcement was made on the Thursday, like, on, you know, in Washington, but by the Taoiseach at the time. And then it was all panic stations. What are we going to do? So we're in touch with them. It was a company out in Donabate that were kind of looking after them. So constantly saying, we need to get these kids home. There was eight of them. But they were what we call railway operations apprentices. They were working with, in Berlin primarily, with the city council, working on the S-Bahn and things like that in Berlin. And they were straight out of school. So they were doing their technical learning. And as part of this, they were sort of coming over here. Of course, it was improving their English and all of that sort of stuff as well. So I don't think we advertise how appropriate or for people apprenticeships can be. And I think some people learn better by doing. Some people are natural kind of, I won't say use the word academics, because that can be very demeaning or something like that. And I don't mean to be that way. I just mean that some people get it quicker than others. But everyone
people
can get
learn
it in a long
like
time.
If you look at learning and development in companies, right? Like mm-hmm. I would fill a lot of learning and development roles, and there's a lot of science behind how people learn, but it's not applied to schools. So you could have someone who is, like, you know, as intelligent as the next person, but maybe just reading it from a book, it's not sinking in. And so whereas if they adapted it to what you would do in a company, you know, where it's like visual, like where you're actively doing it, where you're listening to it, and there's different types of support materials. Also, I think as well, the way, I mean, like, we're not going to fix that on today's podcast, but the way the leaving certain things like that are set up, it's a memory test, you know, at the moment.
It is.
So it's like how much information you can, like, retain for a short period of time for the exam, and then, you know, you move on. So I think it's maybe trying to make it a little bit more useful, but that's not for us to fix.
No. I've always found that learning, I'm not saying anyone can pass an exam. Obviously, there's you know, some people can get, you know, a first or an A or a H1 or whatever, and some people can get a H4 and get a sort of a 2-2. It's not it should never be a measure of anybody, you know. It should be the ability of what you can do with the learning and how you can apply it. And particularly when you talk about work, it's not necessarily what I tend to, in all my years of recruiting as well, while I've been in line HR as well, I've always tended to recruit for attitude. It's my one thing I look for above anything else. Firstly, if you're sitting across the table from me, you either A, have the basic qualifications, whether that's, you know, an undergrad in engineering or marketing, you know, accountancy, whatever you're recruiting for. But do you fit? Do you have the right character? Do you have the right sort of, do I get the confidence from you that you go out? I spoke to our graduate intake this year and I asked them the question, why did you pick us? 34 kind of faces just looked at me and said, and then one brave soul said, well, what do you mean? I said, you had every organization asking you to come and do their graduate training. So why'd you pick here in Red Arrow? And then one person says, well, I like the way your approach to sustainability and the whole green agenda. And I said, okay, thank you. Another person then said, I don't like the way some of the tech companies, the culture within a tech company. And I said, well, so like, that's your own opinion. I says, I don't know much about them, so I can't comment on it, but I appreciate your answer. And I just said I said, not that I'm here to talk about recruiting to you, but says, oh, you do the recruiting. Says, I never do the way around. You should always be, as you're going for a job, you should be asking yourself, can I work with the three people sitting the far side of the table from me? Does it fit me? You know? And my last take of people for HR I took in, none of them had a HR qualification. One is actually an IT graduate. but I just liked her attitude. She just, you know, came across the table as very confident, as very with a can-do attitude. And I said, I like her. And one of the other interview teams says, but she's no qualifications in HR, and says, I can give that learning.
See, what I would say to you as well is that, like, in relation to hiring for attitude, I'd be a big proponent, like, of that, of somebody coming in with the, because you can't teach somebody to have a certain attitude or a certain approach to work. And I've learned that, like, through all the different levels of recruitment that I've gone through. But one thing I would say to you is, I think there's a gentleman named Adam Grant. I don't know if you know him. He does, like, organizational change, but he said that, like, you have to be very careful when an employee or a candidate is joining a company, because if I'm given interview prep, I always try and say, like, you need to look at these people as potentially, you know, your future colleague, you know, someone you're going to have a cup of tea and a biscuit with. So don't put them on, like, you know, don't, like, be looking up to them too much, be respectful, be all of those things. But also, when you're looking at the culture of the company, there's more of a chance of you becoming like the people that you surround yourself with in work, as opposed to that one individual changing the culture. So that, I mean, like, it's interesting for me to hear that, because I would be saying, make sure, like, when you look at the people in the company and what the actual culture is, not just the buzzword that it has on the website, that's kind of the type of person that you're going to become. Would you agree with that?
I would, yeah. And personally, like, I mean, I always like to be, I like difference in people. I like people that will come and say, no, I won't be a big proponent of rap music. I wouldn't like too much rap. My son loves it. And I'm trying to get him into sort of indie. I'm saying, listen to this now. And that was my kind of, you know, Joy Division, The Smiths, that sort of things. And he's now sort of saying to me, okay, will you listen to this? And I said, I will. And I'd listen to it, and there's some of the stuff he listens to I really don't get. But there's other bits I do, like, you know. Yeah. And there is a generational thing as well. But I think it's important for the organization that we just get different people in with different ways of thinking. That's just a personal opinion, because if we're all sort of just sort of, you know, what would you call it, the same.
Or having copies of each other, same background.
I just don't think it works. And the only way you can change an organization in any place is to create a smorgasbord you know, melting pot of things. And then you can build on that, you know, from that point of view. And I always try and sort of to get people who are better than me to work for me, because that keeps me fresh. That's the way I
That's really interesting, though. So there's a couple of things there that you said that gives me pause. So the fact that you, not every leader is like this, because I've had my own issues with... You see, HR professionals, I think, are sometimes hard to see whether they're brilliant at their job or they're not, because it's not like a sales manager where you can look at the numbers.
Yeah.
You know, it's more difficult to gauge. But the fact that you're saying that you want people who are better than you, I don't know, have you heard of Robert Greene, the author?
Yes, I have heard of him.
Yeah. So he has a book, he's loads of books, I recommend him, but he has a book called The 48 Laws of Power. Have you read it?
No, I haven't read it.
No, I'll send you a mini copy, but I give it to everyone. But the first law of the 48 Laws of Power is never outshine the master. And it's not the book, he's not writing it to tell you how to become power hungry. He tells you how to just watch out for different things that people who have been power hungry would do. And a lot of, like, leaders, which takes us, like, nicely onto this, but a lot of leaders, not just HR managers, I don't want to beat them up, but are intimidated by hiring people that are more talented. And that's why they do things like micromanage. You know, they want the person to do a certain task exactly the same way that they would do it. What would you say to them?
Back in 2004, I got my first HR line job. I was absolutely thrilled to get it. And after 3 weeks, I went to my manager and I said, I was resigning. I said, I'm going back to my old job. And he looked at me and said, why? And I said, you're not letting me fall. I said, I can't work with you constantly rechecking and then doing my work for me. I said, what you want is just an administrative officer who'll do some work for you and then you can make a decision. I said, for me personally to grow, I said, I need to fall. I need to learn from you. I says, I need you to pick me up and explain where I went wrong, so that I can then grow. And I was one of the few people who really got on with him. Very good guy, but because he had a tendency to micromanage, but I got on great with him after that. After I sort of, I won't say set the boundaries, the wrong way of putting it, but at least explained to him.
Addressed it.
Yeah. I needed to go. I needed to do this. And I said to myself, and you will fall. And I continue to fall. But it's important that you have a fall within a safety net, and there's a mm-hmm. safety around falling, so that you can pick yourself up again. Like, you know, the bird leaving the nest, or the sort of the toddler just getting up off all fours and then sort of they fall. But mama, dad is there, you know, or granny and granddad or whatever are there to pick them up and sort of say, off we go again, you know? And so that's it.
So did you stay?
I did, yes. Yeah. He said, okay, fair enough. He said, we're working this together then. Nice, it's fine, it's no problem. And I spent 3 great years with him. And moved on then to another work for another great leader in the organization. And then when I left, I bought him. He was a big Munster rugby fan. So I just got him a book that was written by a Munster supporter on following Munster. And so we just had a retirement function, as it happened at the time, for another colleague. And his wife says to me, you're the first person to ever buy him anything. And he says, oh, stop. I said, there has to be someone else. She says, no one else ever did. I says, hey, what did you get out? I says, I got loads. I said, I had to have a row with him at the very beginning, but I got loads.
But I think it sounds like it's a relationship goes two ways. So even though I will be saying that there are some really great leaders, but I would always like recommend to employees, like especially when they come to me and say, I'm leaving, find me another job. It's like, talk to them first, like have that two-way conversation, you know, like I always say, like a closed mouth won't get fed. So you could be sitting at your desk absolutely fuming, steam coming out of your ears, and that person is completely oblivious as to what they have done wrong, or you know, until they get the letter of you handing in your notice.
Mm-hmm. Well, managers used to come to me when I was in line HR and said, that John Kennedy lad, he needs to go. And I said, okay, fine, fair enough. Yeah. Why? He's brutal. He doesn't do this and he doesn't do that. And I said, okay, that's fair enough. Now, paraphrasing conversations.
Yeah, of course.
I'd say to him, so have you told him? And there'd be a look of sort of blank shock on their face. No. What's this? I try and talk to him. Or her, like, you know, and sort of say, you know, you're not doing this right, you're not doing that right. And sort of what managers wanted to tend to do is just come to your door and hand that, because it's a person, inverted commas, hand that problem over to you because you're the people manager. And they forget to understand that line managers are also people managers. They don't see that bit. So they see the targets, they see their KPIs, and that's fine, and they need to be driven. I get that, and no issue. But there are times that, you know, they're team leaders. You know, and that's the difference. I would say not every manager is a leader. You know, leaders are by definition, you know, I don't think there's such a thing as a bad leader, because if you're a bad leader, you're just a manager. You're not a leader. That's my own.
God, I feel like I need to put that on a t-shirt.
You know, because leader is such a positive word in all shapes, size, forms of life. You know, you look at anybody who's a leader, and whether it's society or anything like that, and I just find that. So you have to give people a chance, because by definition, we will fall. You know, we always will. We continue to fall. That's how we learn. But you can't learn if you're, like as you say, if I'm having a row with my manager and I'm not telling him or her, and as you say, just sitting at your desk fuming, and that sort of gets in on you then. That makes it worse, and that makes you then make rash decisions like leaving organizations, in a bad way. And you joined, I think you joined the next organization still with resentment.
Yeah.
And you bring that
you
with
carry
you.
It. Yeah, yeah, you definitely do. You carry it with you. And I'm like, of course, there's people like, you know, you need to open your mouth and have a conversation and be respectful and all of those things. But I completely agree with you in relation to, you know, you have a leader or you have a bad manager. And I know for me in the recruitment industry, it's very hard to get recruiters and keep them, you know, for them in agency and for them not to go in-house. So a lot of what the agencies used to do is they promote their biggest fillers. But if you look at the skills to be a leader, which is not putting your wants and needs first, you know, the kind of focusing on the people around you and helping them achieve their career goals, that's at odds with what the biggest filler will be looking for, because it's very much me closing the deal, you know, and it's a different skill set. So when these people, not all of them, like there were some who were great, but they weren't set up for success, because then they only wanted the team around them to operate in the same level. So the fact that you were saying that to me was very, very interesting, that it happens in different industries as well. As we come to a close of today, one of the questions that I would like to ask you is, like, what would next steps look like for you in relation to your career? And I mean, because it sounds like you have a lot of projects going on.
For me, I suppose I'm trying to look to do different things, not necessarily within what I do in work, but externally to work. Like, I mean, I've gone involved with the CIPD. I've recently been co-opted onto the National Committee. So I'm trying to do a bit in that sense. And it is more about me personally, I think, at this stage of my life rather than professionally. And I say that from a comfortable space in that sense, you know. And I think if we don't, like any of the sort of the I won't say inspirational books, but I'm a big avid fan of coaches, likes of Vince Lombardi, Bill Walsh, American football coaches, big into how they approached the game. John Wooden, basketball, Coast University, UCLA, just the godfather of coaching, like they call him. And people like that, you know, the Mick O'Dwyer's, Jim Gavin's of this world. And they just have a way of, you know, sort of trying to bring the best out of people. And that's how I feel that they've been successful. They've engendered a spirit within people. So personally, I think if you stop doing what you're doing, you just regress. So I'm still that 16-year-old kid listening to the Smiths and Joy Division. You know, I still have that. Sort of part of that was I went to see a band called Pulp a couple of weeks ago, and they're just genius. They're a Canadian punk rock band, and it was just brilliant to see 20, 22-year-old kids just pogo about, having come through COVID, all of that sort of carry on, living
life.
And I'm still that 22-year-old kid, still that 17-year-old kid. I'm just learning a bit more, just with a bit more experience tucked under the belt.
And now you're getting into rap music.
And now I'm getting into rap music, yeah. Well, trying.
Well, do you know what? I will say this to you. I have like about 4 pages of notes of things that I want to follow up on when this is done and dusted. But my last question is, is there any one key piece of advice? Because that's what this podcast is about. I mean, when we see your job title, and I hope that you realize this, when we see your job title and it, like, you know, an internationally or like nationally known company and the progression that you've had, we think that, like, maybe, you know, you haven't made mistakes or you haven't kind of taken a wrong turn, or it's just like you see the title and not the person. And I really do appreciate you, like, you know, sharing your stories and letting us see like a little bit of the actual man and the 16-year-old and the 22-year-old behind the job title. But is there any piece of advice that you've received or that you would like to share with people, irrespective of what stage they're at? So whether it's like my little cousin Aaron, who's like, you know, starting off in the apprenticeship, or someone thinking about changing jobs, is there any key thing you'd want to share with them?
I suppose it's, you know, there's enough people in the whole world who try and knock everybody. So don't add to it. Don't add your, don't be another one to knock yourself. There's times when you might think I did things wrong, or I might like the way I approached that, and that's fine. But there's learning in everything. And it's just to be, you know, to be a dreamer, it really, to me, is the most important thing, because and they don't have to be Martin Luther King type I have a dream speeches. I'm not saying that, but even just, you know, to sort of say, like, I mean, if I have one ambition, I'd love to sort of play guitar in front of 80,000 people or sing. Now, I can't sing and I can't play guitar, but that doesn't stop me daydreaming about actually doing that. And some people would like to climb Everest. No, I'd love to do that. That would be my sort of thing, because I suppose I'm into music that much. But it's always to dream. You can always be better. You can always improve, and just to learn from your mistakes, because you're going to make buckets of them. And it doesn't matter, the most successful of individuals did. And when you get underneath it, you know, you'll find where, you know, if in their honest times, and they have to be honest with some people, they will admit that. But I think the more that we are open with each other, the more that we do learn from each other and share with each other, I think the better we'll all be. But that's the one thing I would say, just always dream.
Yeah,
always dream.
I love it. And listen, you couldn't end on a better note than that. So thank you so much to you for your time. I've loved it. And I know that all the people who are listening in will have enjoyed our conversation.